bin Dawood alayhi salam, who was given control over the jinn and men along with prophethood and a great position before Allah. But when he finished what was his due in sustenance in this world and exhausted his time, the bow of destruction shot him with the arrow of death. So by having a general view on these verses along with the previous ones, we understand that since the previous verses mentioned the stages of development of man for which Allah admired himself, and these two verses talk about the final stages, we can infer that these two verses are talking about the perfection after death. The growth and the raising starts in this world, but perfection is not achieved in this world, and perfection is actually after death. After touching on the subject of monotheism and the origin of man, the issue of resurrection is mentioned in a very delicate and beautiful way.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qum.
The verse implies that man, with all his marvels and wonders, cannot live eternally in this world, and a time must come when his marvelous structure will fall apart. So the verse says, ثُمَّ إِنَّكُمْ بَعْدَ ذَلِكَ لَمَيِّتُونَ. Then verily after that you shall die. And this seems to be another stage of perfection for human beings. The Prophet ﷺ says, death is like a bunch of fragrant flowers for the believer. And death is beneficial for those who have made faith and piety the practice of their hearts. So this stage is different based upon what kinds of acts and deeds you've had during your life in the world. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, death is the cause of tranquility for the prosperous. So somehow, in some sense, it could be relative, because the Prophet in this regard has said, unexpected death is a relief for the believer and a wrath for the unbelievers. The nature of death is the same, but it differs based on which kind of actions you have had in the world. And actually, reminding yourself of when the death comes is one of those tricks to prepare yourself for when you will actually receive the rewards of your deeds. Or if someone is unbeliever, he would receive the wrath of Allah. Imam Hadi alayhi salam says, remember when you will be lying on the bed of death before your household, and neither can any physician prevent your death, nor can any friend help you. And this fact is actually emphasized in the next verse, that it actually expresses that death is not destruction, but a stage of perfection. So, in order to neutralize the idea that a person dies and therefore everything ends, which would make the magnificence of this creation pointless, Allah immediately says afterwards, ثُمَّ إِنَّكُمْ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ تُبَعْثُونَ. Then verily, on the day of resurrection, you will be raised again. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله. لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah. Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In these series of shows, we are trying to ask and answer some doubts and misconceptions, which is usually being asked by different questioners and theological and Islamic issues. So for this series of shows, we have been inviting scholars and researchers from Qom Seminary Schools. Like always, we have Sheikh Murtada Karimi in the studio with us, and we shall start our questions with him. But before starting the discussion, I'd like to welcome Sheikh and say salam to Sheikh Murtada.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikhuna. The question of the day that we want to ask it from the respected guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, is concerning the fasting in the holy month of Ramadan. There are some doubts or misconceptions with regard to the fasting and issues related to fasting that we needed to, and that we found it necessary to ask this question here in this show, though the question has come to us from a questioner. But it has been asked, Sheikh, that fasting in the holy month of Ramadan for 30 consecutive days actually reduces the immunity of the body and actually weakens the strength of a body, and actually it makes it apt. It makes it apt to receive different kinds of, let's say, sicknesses or diseases. Is it true that fasting in the holy month of Ramadan reduces the power of a person and also the immunity system, so that it makes it actually ready for receiving any kind of disease? Is it what the science today says so? In case it is actually accepted, is there any solution for that? While also we have heard that even recently with the issues regarding the pandemic of the COVID-19, that all the world actually has been afflicted with, this idea can be strengthened, and actually this question can come to the board and to be asked more by different questioners. So what is a scientific or Islamic answer to this question?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Especially in the recent years, in which in many countries people have been fasting for many hours during the day, I can say that unfortunately this notion has been preached by some people that Islam is against the health of the people, because fasting for 30 consecutive days in hot days and for more than 16 and 17 hours, it is for sure harmful to the body, and in that Islam is against the health of the people. Now, the answer is that one phrase of the Quran consists of three words, has answered all the doubts 14 centuries ago. Islam is not against science.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever fasting is harmful to the health of a person, and of course the person is sure about that and it is a considerable harm,
mm-hmm.
Islam says that not only you are not allowed to fast, but rather if you fast, it is an act of disobedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is haram, it is forbidden. If you are sure that fasting is against your health, if you are sick, and the specialists tell you that you do not, you shouldn't fast, then even if you fast, not only it is not accepted, rather it is an act of disobedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You are doing something haram. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in chapter Baqarah, after referring to the fact that fasting is an obligation, Allah says, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ. The month of Ramadan is the one in which the Holy Quran was sent down as a guidance for mankind with manifest proofs of guidance and the criterion. فَمَنْ شَهِدَ مِنْكُمُ الشَّهْرَ فَلْيَصُمْ. So let those of you who witness it fast in it. وَمَنْ كَانَ مَرِيضًا أَوْ عَلَى سَفَرٍ فَعِدَّةٌ مِّنْ أَيَّامٍ أُخَرٍ. And as for someone who is sick or on a journey, let it be a similar number of other days. يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ بِكُمُ الْيُسْرِ وَلَا يُرِيدُ بِكُمُ الْعُسْرِ. Allah desires ease for you, and He does not desire hardship for you. Now, it is very strange that these people who are anti-Islam, they claim that Islam is against health and hygiene, but we see that here Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala himself says that I do not desire hardship for the people, I desire ease. يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ بِكُمُ الْيُسْرِ. Of course, we do not, we are not going to claim that because fasting is somehow difficult for most of the people, they shouldn't fast. No, this is not the case. At the end of the day, fasting is to some extent difficult, but is it harmful to the body? Islam says that if the answer is positive, you shouldn't fast. Man kana maridan, only three words. So answering all doubts which are raised today regarding the immunity system and the pandemic and the fact that, and the claim that fasting weakens the immunity system, Islam says that if you're sure about that, that fasting is harmful to your body and it is a considerable harm, then you shouldn't fast. But we have no, I mean, dispute here. I mean, sometimes you see that some people try to say that no, fasting is good for the health. Some people say that no, it's harmful. Islam says that if you are sure that it is harmful, you shouldn't fast, period. I mean, there is no dispute over that.
Mm-hmm.
So you know about your conditions of your body, you know about your illnesses and so on and so forth. If you are sure, then you follow what you are sure about. If not, you refer to an expert in that regard and follow
mm-hmm.
his or her instruction. It's not, I mean, a big deal.
Yeah.
Now, I just searched about the relation between fasting and immunity system, and I came across different researchers done mainly by non-Muslims, which tell us that this claim at least is not absolutely true, the claim that that fasting weakens the immunity system. Let me read the conclusion of some researchers in this regard. According to one research, which is published in a website called ScienceDirect.com, it says, in summary, our results suggest that 30 days intermittent fasting from dawn to sunset can be a preventive and therapeutic approach in cancer, as well as in several metabolic, inflammatory, and immune diseases, Alzheimer's disease, and neuropsychiatric disorders, by resulting in a proteome protective against obesity, diabetes, inflammation, and mental health. Another research reads, in the year 2014, a study, Walter Longo and his colleagues at USC found that fasting lowered white blood cell counts, which in turn triggered the immune system to start producing new white blood cells. White blood cells are a key component of your body's immune system. Once you start eating again, according to Longo, your stem cells kick back into high gear to replenish the cells that were recycled. The idea behind this strategy is that you have to fast for several days to get the benefits. Basically, you have to fully deplete your energy reserves, and it takes your body at least 24 hours and probably 48 hours or more to do this. And just one another research says fasting during, now we come to the concept of fasting and COVID-19. It was raised in the last year that some people believe that fasting is against the immunity system, and it makes more likely to for people to be afflicted by COVID-19 if they fast. Again, I repeat, the clear-cut answer is that if you are sure about that and you know that it will bring a great harm to your body, then you shouldn't fast. This is very clear.
Can anyone actually reach to this conclusion to do personal ijtihad or personal, let's say, ijtihad?
Deduction.
Personal deduction that, okay, it looks harmful and then he leaves fasting. Is it enough?
Let me read the result of a research about the relation between fasting and COVID-19, and then I will come to your question. Again, this is the result of one research. Maybe some other scholars, they are going to reject that. But according to this study, it says that fasting during the COVID-19 pandemic is a challenge for Muslims. However, UGM nutritionist Dr. Bodeningsari said that fasting is beneficial to the immune system or immunity. She says several studies say fasting can increase immunity. Vice versa, there have been no studies that state fasting increases the risk of COVID-19 infection. The head of the Health Nutrition Study Program of the Faculty of Medicine, Public Health and Nursing said that fasting could repair damaged cell tissues.
Yeah.
By fasting for 30 days, it can stimulate the production of new white blood cells. It underlies the regeneration of the entire immune system, and it continues. And also, she explained that the quality and quantity of nutritional intake immensely influence the body's immunity. People who experience malnutrition will be very vulnerable to COVID-19 infection. Not only does it enhance immunity, but fasting also helps detoxify the body. Fasting can help remove various poisons that are stored in the body. For example, addictive substances in foods such as preservatives and food coloring. Fasting can also reduce body fat mass. Excess fat in the body can damage the balance of the human immune system because the excess fat will trigger cell production, which causes inflammation of the body's organs, triggering the emergence of vascular diseases and other health problems. Now, this is the viewpoint of this scholar, and I think she's not a Muslim scholar. But anyway, back to your question. So, as I mentioned, if you're a specialist and you know that based because the conditions, the physical conditions of each person is different. It differs from one body, one person to another person. So Islam leaves the, conclusion and judgment to yourself. If you are sure about the fact that fasting is harmful to you, you should not fast. If you have doubts, then you need to refer to those people that you believe they are expert in this regard.
So it's not that easy to say, for example, it is harmful when you just surfing the net, finding that an article saying that it is.
Exactly, this is the
actually
point.
Opposing what you have heard, what you have read for us, actually, which looks to be scientific. So it is not that easy to find any article and refer to that and to say that it is harmful for the body.
Yeah, at the end of the day,
need to reach to a certainty that it is harmful.
Yeah, and finally, the certainty of each person matters. Of course, he or she should try to find the best, answer to this question. As I mentioned, if they are expert, then they can find out the answer. Otherwise, they need to refer to the best experts in that regard that they can rely on.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your answers, and you respected listeners for staying tuned and listening to us in Q&A on Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio.
لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing US Election Day documentary 11-8-16, produced and created by Jeff Deutschman. And joining me in the studio, we have Anna Smith, who is a film critic and broadcaster. She is also the president of the UK Critics Circle and a regular film critic for various mainstream channels. And beside her, we are also joined by Jonathan Fryer, who is a lecturer, broadcaster and freelance writer. Now, on the 8th of November 2016, Americans from all walks of life went to the ballot box to vote for their next president. Though little did they know at the time what would be in store for them, after most people believed that the country would be seeing its first female president be elected. This documentary, which features the work of many directors and film crews, follows a cross-section of Americans throughout that fateful day and shows the complex and diverse spectrum of opinions about their reasons for voting for Trump or for Clinton, or in some cases, not voting at all.
Days to election, I can update this. Did you vote today?
I voted early.
You did?
Friday.
Did it feel great?
Today, I'm going to vote for the first time in over 30 years.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm a little nervous about the outcome of the election, the future for the coal industry.
You can't stop doing politics. Knock on doors, say, hey, excuse me, did you vote today? Be polite. It's a beautiful day.
The election will be over by 9 o'clock, so call it by 9:30, and everything will be peaceful and wonderful.
What if it goes the other way?
What? Not going to go the other way. No way. Mark it down.
Thank you.
I could feel eyes watching me as I walked through that crowd, like they hated me, like I was Donald Trump.
They say, you know, your vote may make a difference, but to me, I don't think so.
It looks like maybe we should be planning for the too close to call scenario or the Trump win.
Who we had as president, African Americans were still the lowest man on the totem pole.
There's hope. Never forget that the power of the people is stronger than the people in power.
Well, that was the trailer to 11/8/16. First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for both of you for coming on. Now, this documentary could be seen as quite a historic and invaluable piece of filmmaking, as it gives the world viewers an insight, a sort of a window into the psyche of Americans voting that day and what they were thinking. And Anna, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you're right that it's an interesting snapshot of Americans, and it also has an emotive subject, a fascinating subject, which all great documentaries need. And what all great documentaries need as well is great characters. And this has lots of really strong characters, people who are voting from different sides, who strongly believe in what they're talking about, and the access to them on a day that is a very important day in their lives means that there's some explosive conversations and some very telling and revealing conversations. So broadly, I liked it.
That's a great opinion. And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna just said?
Yes, I mean, the technique of the documentary was really interesting. The producers called it a periscope view, with 16 periscopes popping up across all the way from New York over to Hawaii, even interviewing different families and individuals. And of course, it's fascinating because watching it, we know the outcome. But during the film itself, until right at the end, the actual voters are not aware of the outcome, but many of them are really, really engaged, as they either want to Hillary Clinton to win, as what was expected originally, or they're rooting for Trump. And it's fascinating to see how their mood changes, in some cases optimistically, in other way, in for other people, disastrously, as they see exactly what they didn't want to happen and literally are brought to tears.
And the dramatic irony of it actually is what makes the film so fascinating and relevant today to watch, actually. And I just want to talk about Jeff Dutchman's previous work. He made a similar film about Obama's election campaign and his supporters. And I bet we can imagine that probably had a different tone than compared to this film. What do you think, Anna?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very different, because of course it's fascinating. He goes about these films without knowing the outcome. But obviously people were much more optimistic about Obama winning, and this was a bit of a surprise result in this case. So it's fascinating to think that when he and all the directors involved, because he sort of curated this, and there were
and
all these other
directors. And what a feat for filmmaking, actually. I wonder how difficult that must have been to coordinate.
Yeah, he sourced a lot of great filmmakers from all over the world who were very talented, and obviously a lot of them probably had a connection with their subjects, which gave rise to some very, very interesting people and subjects. But yeah, I mean, it just watching it in retrospect then makes it particularly interesting, of course, because there is this sense of perhaps impending doom or success, depending on your point of view, that you just know is going to be a real shock to some people that you're watching. So it adds to the tension.
It was a great collaborative project indeed. And Jonathan, just quickly before we move on, if you could just take us back to that time, why was it so shocking for Trump to win? And in hindsight, is it actually that surprising?
He was an extraordinary candidate and, of course, has become now a very extraordinary president, because he was absolutely not the normal run-of-the-mill politician, basically. He was anti-politician. And so it was an enormous shock when he was elected. And everyone did expect, most people expected, Hillary Clinton would win. And I'm sure the director was thinking, right, but it didn't happen.
And it was much to everyone's surprise, actually.
So you are in the vast majority of the populace that does not vote. How are you feeling about that?
I feel pretty good. More than we are
voting for any particular candidate. We are voting for the system. And it is a system that I just don't abide by. We don't need new legislation. We don't need a new politician. We don't need the Constitution to change to actually like care for our community. You just have to have the will. That's where I put my effort. I put my effort there because I think change comes from the work that we do, not from the ballot box.
My white people have always had the right to vote, right? Like my lineage has always been, we've been the power, right? So what would you say to somebody who would be like, wait a minute, you're African American?
You mean like my grandmother?
Yeah, like your grandmother.
As much as I really honor the nothing less than heroics that it took in order for African Americans to be able to vote. You know, getting the right to vote was the equivalent of walking into a room. A game of Monopoly was being played by all rich white men. The game was already in motion. Property was already bought. Hotels already built. And African Americans earned a right to sit at the table. They earned a right to sit at the table, start in jail, didn't collect $200, start off with no money, no property, nothing. That's a game you cannot win. And it's about time that we walk in and wipe the whole damn game off the table and start over.
I think one of the most prominent issues this documentary exposes is the clear racial division in the U.S. Thinking back to the scene where we see in Chicago African Americans talking amongst themselves sort of the conflict they feel in having to choose between Trump or Clinton, and they say that Clinton obviously isn't the great candidate for them either, considering the whole super predator count scandal and the three strikes you're out sort of thing, and then Trump isn't so great on minorities either. Anna, could you just tell us, did this documentary, was it effective in exposing this racial divide and how complicated this issue is?
I think you're right, it is an extremely complicated issue, and it's very hard in the space of a documentary like this, especially with so many different people and so many different directors, to really get to the heart of the issue. But at the same time, it did touch on a lot of that, and it was very careful, I think, to have a variety of people from different sides and of different races talking about how they felt about it. And I thought the filmmakers succeeded in getting people to be very frank about racial issues, as we saw just there, and very articulate. So it was thought-provoking for me on that level.
And Jonathan, would you agree? Do you think this documentary exposed the divided
nation? Well, I think it really stressed the diversity, rather than the division, the diversity of the American population, people who've been there for generations, some who are very new immigrants. It's interesting, it starts with a Sikh taxi driver who is clearly from a Punjabi family who've probably very recent immigrants and rather excited by the idea that they will be able to vote. So in that sense, I think it's extremely valuable in showing the different races, ethnicities, religions, etc., that make up the United States. But without a doubt, some people very clearly in the film felt disenfranchised even if they were able to vote. It's interesting, it ended with a very poor couple in Hawaii living in a tent in a park who basically sort of say, well, you know, okay, it was election, but what sort of difference is it going to make to our lives? Nothing whatsoever.
And I like how it came actually full circle to that point, actually, that some people are very helpless when it comes to politics and it doesn't make a difference to them. So I just want to talk about some statistics now. Data from the election actually shows that the majority of young white Americans, both male and female, under 44 years old, voted for Hillary Clinton, whereas those mostly over 45 overwhelmingly voted for Trump. So Jonathan, why do you think Americans voted the way they did?
Well, there clearly was a very stark generational divide. It's rather interesting, we had a very similar phenomenon here in Britain in 2016 with a EU referendum in which 45 and over majority voted to leave the EU, 44 and younger voted to stay. So there clearly is something happening between the different generations. But what was really also very interesting about the statistics in the US election was that people outside the cities voted for Trump. It was sort of like a rural revolution of people, particularly older people who maybe had seen their hopes dashed for a brighter future and were therefore determined to go out and to make a protest, basically.
Well, we're lucky to have Jonathan here to give us political context to this. I was just quickly wondering, Anna, would you have liked for more political context to these stories?
I think it's also well publicised now that even the most casual observer of the news will know exactly what happened on that day and what the results were and what the ramifications would go on to be for the people that we see on camera. I found it interesting as someone that doesn't necessarily follow every inch of the political news to find out who, you know, the sort of makeup of the voters and the characters of the voters, because, and particularly the Trump voters, because you hear a lot about and see a lot about Trump himself, but to see who actually voted for him and then giving the reasons why, I found fascinating.
And of course we actually learned that a lot of people who voted for Trump were scared to admit they voted for Trump, so it was only in the aftermath that we really found what was actually happening.
How is it going?
I am working on the next day cartoon at the moment.
Oh, nice.
I'm still making a bold assumption of how this will go.
I think you're safe.
This is the ink drawing, and then
very nice.
Colored in on the computer. Political cartooning is, it's called the jugular art for a good reason. It's almost always negative. So for once, I'm actually being kind of, got a positive message here, which may turn out not to be true.
Yeah, we'll see.
But yeah, it just
can you just alter it like somebody like pushing her back through the ceiling or something later?
That would be good. Yeah. I bet I'll get this one out of the way and then see what happens.
I'm glad we got to see the sort of behind the scenes of the media rooms and them preparing for the election result. And they largely believed Clinton was going to win. Anna, what could we learn from the documentary about the role media or social media played in the election?
It was fascinating, wasn't it, that they felt that they kind of knew, I mean, they prepared for every scenario, but there was that confidence in the polls, which evidently was misplaced. So I think a lot of journalists could probably learn from that scenario, from watching that. I certainly found it fascinating watching those journalists there sort of hedging their bets, but basically thinking that Hillary was going to win. In terms of the media, in terms of people from all walks of life making assumptions based on what they see and hear, and also when you see people in this documentary watching the results come on screen on their own TV screens, you just see how sheltered some of those people are on both sides and how little they understand about other people's opinions, and how we become, you know, even in social media we only really follow people with a similar point of view, which isn't, social media is not really explored in this, but I think that's something that is a springboard for thinking about that.
Definitely. And it raises many questions, actually. And Jonathan, if I could put that question to you, what role do you think actually the media, indeed social media, played on the election?
Well, it's two different things, the mainstream media and the social media. The mainstream media, it was clear that most of them, with exceptions such as Fox News, were rooting for Hillary Clinton and firmly expected her to win, though obviously they had to make provision for a result of a different kind. Social media was an entirely different matter, because there, the Trumpers, if we can call them that, were really in the ascendant. And this is the first presidential election in the United States where social media had a huge impact. Donald Trump himself has millions of followers, and whereas many people may say, well, a lot of what he tweets about on Twitter is rubbish or untrue, it has a huge effect, and he has that great following. And he, of course, despises the mainstream media, talks about fake news, because the liberal commentators on the LA Times and other newspapers, of course, are opposed to the sorts of things that he believes in and propagates.
And why is it that so many people could believe this, though, that he could label the certain news channels fake news, and he was so hostile to the press?
Well, we've come into what's called the post-truth world, where it's no longer, is true that you necessarily accept, but it's what you believe is truth. In other words, if it fits in with your own prejudices and your own approach, then that's fine. That's the news, and that's what you're going to put forward.
And so there's so many interesting questions then that this documentary could raise. Do you think there's any other points and strong themes that this documentary had?
Well, I felt like it could have gone further. It could have shown more Trump supporters, as I said. Could have been more revealing. But in terms of the points it made, for me, characters are such a huge part of it. And to see the dynamic, particularly between one of the husband and wife in Massachusetts, and she's a little bit more reserved about Trump, and he's really gung-ho. And to see the difference between families and couples and generations and how they interpret politics and speak to each other about politics, I thought was really, really interesting.
And that's an interesting point, actually, not to defend Trump supporters, but you realise that they're human beings and not all of them are evil, but they have different motivations and grievances for voting in terms of the whole system and their fight, especially when it comes to finances, I think, in the documentary.
A
lot of times I work a long day. I'm out of the house before my kids even get out of bed. And then when I come home, it's 6 o'clock at night, it's dark, you know, it's time to eat dinner and go to bed, basically. So if the economy got better and I was bringing more people and more work into my shop and I could delegate a little bit more, then I'd be able to spend more time with my family. That'd be huge. That would be huge for me. I'm doing okay for myself right now, but it would be even that much better, you know? I don't know. I think if when Hillary gets elected, and I think she's going to get elected because she's going to
cheat.
She's going to cheat. If she's going to raise the taxes on everybody, and healthcare right now is crushing us anyway, so I'm concerned that we're going to have a tough time making ends meet.
It's not right. And you know Hillary doesn't care about anything but her pockets.
So this family are quite entertaining to watch. What contribution do you think they made to the documentary?
They brought an entertainment factor, I think, which is really important. There's nothing to say that documentaries about political subjects need to be entirely serious. And it was sort of dark humour, but just seeing the dynamic between them was really involving and entertaining. But it also showed, as I said earlier, that you can, within a couple, see different political views and see different strains and strengths, but also what worrying things that people might be influencing each other and perhaps voting in what they don't personally actually really believe in. They're being swayed.
And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna said?
Yeah, they were a fascinating family, and they raised two issues there in that clip which are really important. In other words, tax, because Trump was saying he was going to cut taxes particularly for the higher income earners, which would be attractive to business people. And the other thing was Obamacare. One of the huge things that really figured in the election was the cost of Obamacare. President Obama brought in a system where poor people had medical insurance.
Surely
which
that's
we think
a good
is
thing.
Great.
Of
Isn't course,
that akin to
of
the
course,
NHS
but the Trumpers,
to
on the other hand, were saying we're paying for all these people to do that. But very interesting point made by a number of people during the film is they were voting against someone rather than for someone. Mm. And that's why Hillary lost, even though, of course, she actually got more votes than Trump did in the popular vote.
About 2.9% more.
But she was more unpopular than Trump was. Mm-hmm.
And does that expose flaws, then, I suppose, in the American voting system?
Well, to us in Britain, which we don't have a flawless system here either, but it does seem really weird that someone can win the popular vote but lose the presidency.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, and I just wanted to talk about the parallels, actually, between the UK and the US and theatrical aspect of the US. I was just wondering, is there a documentary of this sort that would be as fascinating in the UK as it would be to follow an American election? Do you think it would be as interesting?
Well, obviously, Brexit docs are fascinating, aren't they? I mean, that's the closest thing we've had recently. You're right, though, the Americans do have a showy way about them. But goodness, look at reality TV shows in the UK. We've certainly got our fair share of big personalities. So I think good documentaries can always find them.
Yes. Oh, no, that's a good point, actually. I just wanted to get, Anna, your final thoughts on this documentary, and also would you recommend it?
I don't think it's an earth-shattering documentary, but I think it's very, very interesting. And I think if you want a further insight into what motivated a lot of American people to place their vote a certain way, then it's well worth the watch.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, if I turn to you, your final thoughts on the film,
yeah,
would you recommend it?
When it first started, I thought, oh my goodness, we're going to watch this for an hour and 45 minutes, am I going to really be interested? But you do get interested in the characters, in the individual families. In fact, I was disappointed when it finished.
Mm-hmm. And we'll have to leave it there on that good note to end it on. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe,
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Islam, the Holy Prophet, the Quran, in very clear ways have mentioned that there's no distinction between people and human beings based on gender or ethnicity. The way we Muslimin look at women, we do not consider women to be at par with men. We don't see that. There is an inferiority that is there. It has even seeped into and found its way, unfortunately, into some of the ahadith. The ahadith are not from the Prophet or the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in. They are ahadith that have been attributed to the Ahlul Bayt, to the Prophet. Is that they're deficient in faith, deficiency in aql, in intelligence, and deficiency in faith, in iman. But because it's attributed to the Holy Prophet and found some in some hadith book, no! It goes against the Holy Quran. Not only do we not have hadith that says they are different, we have hadith that suggests they are the same. And gender does not make a difference in intelligence. And therefore, with this demonstration, it is clear. These small attributions found here and there, be it in Nahjul Balagha or some other book, they are rare hadith, they are shadh hadith. The abundance of hadith and clear verses of the Holy Quran tell us that this cannot be the word of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Those cannot be the words of the Holy Prophet. Absolutely not. Let's not make this a religious thing. Religion teaches us that in order for men to get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they have got to get past this shuhun nafs, this feeling of superiority that is in them, and then they justify it religiously with these ahadith that are there, al-ayadu billah, or the rulings in Islam that people speculate and say this is the reason. Absolutely not. There's an abundance of hadith that says iman is increased, or when iman is increased in a man, his relation with women, the way he approaches women, the way he sees women, is such that he does not have that feeling of difference and agitation. When you have this feeling that you don't see them the same, when they speak to you, you don't feel the same as when, and there's a lot of complaints about this, husbands not being able to converse with their spouses, with their wives, in nearly the same way. They can't have a nice conversation. They like to spend time, hours talking to their friends, male friends. When it comes to their wife, they're not willing. It says that when the iman of a man increases, this changes in them. This changes. This is what Islam says. Islam says this needs to change. This thought process needs to change. This ideology needs to change. Not that, God forbid, al-ayadu billah, I'm ashamed to say, but I will say it, because it's important for us to pick these things out and throw them out. Not throw the person out. May Allah forgive him for this. Mullah Sadra is a scholar known for his philosophy. And those who are in the field of philosophy, who are experts of it, I'm not an expert in philosophy. I have studied it. I like it to a degree, but I'm not an expert in philosophy. There are scholars who are experts in philosophy as well. Or some who are have just specifically studied that discipline. He's a great scholar in philosophy, in so on and so on. However, unfortunately, there's something he has said in his book that is outrageous. He has explicitly said women are animals that have been created for the pleasure of mankind. I'm so ashamed of this, and it sounds so wrong, it clearly, that it's hard to believe that a scholar would say this. When I first read this, I couldn't believe it. I had to go find the book, make sure it's an authentic copy, and then find it and see it for myself. And unfortunately, I did. It's there. And unfortunately, one of his successors, as one of the great scholars in philosophy, seems to have agreed with him, and then unfortunately tried to justify his words by mentioning some verses of the Holy Quran, which are completely off, have nothing to do with that outrageous statement. What is this? Why is this in our books? Why is this in there? It tells us, the reason why I'm saying this, let me get this very straight, make this crystal clear. The objective of this whole conversation here, Allah knows, is not to put down this author or that author. That's not the objective. Let no one make a mistake on that. It is to clear up our ideology, our belief system, our thought process. We need to change how our fathers look at their daughters, how our husbands look at their wives, how men in the community view women in the community. We've got to change that. And one of the obstacles that clearly is in the way is the thought, the assumption, the wrong understanding that this is actually religious. Even though some of us may not have accepted it fully, it just leaves this lingering thought there, what if it is? And what I'm trying to do is make it crystal clear. Not only is there a justification for it, people have spent time trying to explain, maybe Ali ibn Abi Talib meant this or that, or maybe it's not authentic. I am presenting to you what my research, this is an area, I'm not an expert in philosophy, but this is an area that I have spent a lot of time in. And I can tell you, it is definitely the case that these are not the words of Ali ibn Abi Talib. 100%. On the day of judgment, may Allah curse me if Ali ibn Abi Talib has said these and I said it's not his. I am that clear on the matter. 110%. Allah is a witness. Those words attributed to the Holy Prophet, al-ayadu billah, they go against the Quran. Do not even have a lingering thought in your head that maybe that. No, they're absolutely not. If any thought comes to your head that, yeah, you know, these are women, they just don't understand, know that that's shaitan. That is 100% shaitan. It's not Allah, it's not the Messenger, it's not Ali ibn Abi Talib, it's not Imam al-Sadiq, it's Iblis himself. Okay. Beyond a shadow of a doubt. And it feeds into the nafs of a man to feel that way. It's clear, it's so clear, so blatant that this feeds into the nafs. And it comes from the nafs of some men that perhaps, maybe, I don't know who put those there. That Sharif al-Radi, he didn't fabricate it, I'm sure of that. He saw it somewhere. But what we have seen is this. We have seen many times a person who has a certain view that is not correct, they listen to a great person and then they say that person said what they believe, not even necessarily deliberately trying to do that. For example, those who believe in Wilayatul Faqih and believe in the leadership of Ayatollah Khamenei, we have seen scholars, speakers, politicians, they've been in the same session, Ayatollah Khamenei speaks, and one of them comes out and says, this is what the leader said. That's their understanding. But the problem is, their understanding is flawed. It's problematic. They misunderstood the leader. They attributed those words to him. They weren't trying to attribute a lie. That was really what they thought he meant of it. But they didn't use his words. We've seen much of that. Too much of that, okay? That doesn't mean we question everything that's attributed to the prophet. It means we go to the method that the prophet mentioned to us. The prophet said, go to the Quran. If it does not match up with the Quran, hit it against the wall. Slam it against the wall. Throw it away. That's what needs to be done. And this is one area that this needs to happen, brothers and sisters. We have got to change the understanding that we have as Muslimin towards women to what Islam says about women. The clear verses, the numerous verses of the Quran, the numerous hadith of the Ahlul Bayt, numerous hadith of the Holy Prophet. Go and look at those and correct our understanding of women, the way we need to behave towards women, the way women need to see themselves and behave towards themselves. Correct it.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense,